This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. From a backwoods crossroads described by the British as a hornet's nest of rebellion and as a trifling place by George Washington, to a shining new South City whose population growth has catapulted it into the top 25 cities in the country, Charlotte has finally arrived. But the story of that arrival has usually been gleaned in bits and pieces. Well, now, writer and historian Chuck McShane is creating a clearer picture of how we got to where we are today through a series of articles for Charlotte Magazine, which began in May. In this 12-part series, McShane is stitching together a comprehensive history extending from our Scotch-Irish beginnings to our status as a major American city. And this hour, he shares some of that history with us. Welcome back to the program.
Glad to be here.
I'd like to point out that I thought, as I sat down to prepare for this program, that we've done shows on the history of Charlotte before. What could I possibly learn that I haven't learned before? And I'm here to tell you that I found lots of stuff that you've written about that I did not know. So I think our listeners will, too.
That's great.
It's amazing. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, where you can also find a link to some of the stories that Chuck McShane has written, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, too. What made you embark on this story of the history of Charlotte on the installment plan, so to speak?
Right. Well, I guess there was some element of laziness to it. You know, a 12-part series, I don't have to do 12 more pitches, you know, every month. But really, like you said, you know, I've lived in Charlotte for about a decade now, and I've heard stories about the history told in bits and pieces, the trifling place, the hornet's nest, but never really got the context behind it. So I really wanted to dive deep, do some research, and hopefully tell some people stories they hadn't heard before and provide some context for the why. You know, why did Washington call us a trifling place?
And you're only four installments into a 12-part series here, but I have to ask this, since you have a book coming out in September, The History of Lake Norman, Fish Camps to Ferraris. Is there a book in this?
There's been some talk about it, but we you know, no official plans yet.
Okay. How much of the history of Charlotte were you familiar with before you started doing the research that you've done to make this series happen?
Well, I'd done some research. I'd done some other stories about the history of Charlotte in the past for Charlotte Magazine, and I knew a little bit more, I guess, than the average person because I had done some research about it, but not so much. Again, it was sort of bits and pieces here and there.
How did you approach it? I mean, since it's a 12-part series and you're starting near the beginnings of Charlotte, how it all began, and to where we are today, did you map it all out? Did you know that in series, for instance, Article 7, you'll be writing about what, post-Civil War? Article 8, you'll be writing about the Industrial Revolution, Charlotte. Did you map it all out, or is this kind of coming together as you're doing it?
A general rough outline of topics I kind of got together, but it's coming together as I do it because I'm able to really focus on each era as I go through, and sometimes you come up with new things that you hadn't heard about in one era that you can take to the next.
How far back did you go?
17 to the beginning of the Scotch-Irish settlement here in 1749.
1749. It wasn't called Charlotte then.
No, it was Mecklenburg. Well, it was Anson County, actually.
So let's start back at the beginning here. Charlotte was established at this crossroads of two Native American trading paths. I think everybody knows that's the square, that's Trade and Tryon. Is that really true?
Yes and no. If the courthouse hadn't have been built here, the crossroads wouldn't have really developed the way it did. It was really the courthouse thing.
So, and that came well after 1749.
Yeah, 1760s.
So before that, what was this? Just a scattering of individual cabins and lean-tos and other frontier kind of buildings that were not really connected as a place per se?
Well, there were scattered settlements around the creeks, Sugar Creek, Rocky River, and Presbyterian churches sort of were the center of those communities.
But how did they refer to where they were?
Usually they would say Sugar Creek or Rocky River.
So it wasn't a name of a city or a town or a village?
No, and sometimes they would refer to the county. But.
And you know, most you just pointed out something interesting, because most major American cities, particularly in the colonial days, cities like Boston and Philadelphia and New York and other places, were founded either on deep water ports or on the banks of rivers, particularly as you began to go out west. Places like Cincinnati were established on rivers. We were not. why not? I mean, the Catawba is not that far to the west of where we sit today. Why didn't downtown start or grow up there? Does anybody know?
The Catawba is not really navigable, so you can only get sort of flat bottom.
But there's
ships.
Water.
Right.
And you have to have water to live.
Right. Well, the creeks also provide water. And really, the road, the Great Wagon Road, which went from the Catawba settlement all the way to Pennsylvania, came through this area. It basically was Tryon Street. So that's sort of why it was established.
And this
here.
Great Wagon Road, mm-hmm. why was it there? Where were people going? I mean, we know that up north there mm-hmm. were places like Boston and Philadelphia, New York. I don't know how much far. I'm not sure that Pittsburgh existed back then. But why were they coming here? There was nothing here.
Well, it was a sort of an old rough trail that had been established by Native American tribes before. And in the 1740s, Pennsylvania and Maryland start to get crowded, start to get expensive. So Scots-Irish settlers looking for a new place to live head down the road.
Now, when you said crowded, I read that in one of your articles, and I thought that's interesting because they were in western Pennsylvania. These people did not come from the thriving, now considered tiny metropolis of Philadelphia. They were coming from the western frontier of Pennsylvania and Maryland, not exactly big city locations. How many people were they fleeing from? What was crowded about those areas?
Well, it was I think our concept of land is a little different. You know, they needed a lot more to grow cash crops and that sort of thing. They were also fleeing some religious persecution as well, or really religious taxes, and as well as fights with the Native American tribes there. So there were a number of reasons.
Yeah, you're right that they were tired of paying tax money to a church they despised, the mm-hmm. Church of England.
Right.
If you lived in the colonies, you paid taxes to the Church of England, and the Church of England had to bless or preside over marriages and things like that. Even if you weren't an Anglican church member,
right. They
had control, and they resented that because they were Presbyterian. Mm-hmm. And so they came here. Why? Because there was nothing here. Right. There were no Anglican churches to pay taxes to?
For the most part. I mean, yeah, there were no – technically, on paper, there were Anglican parishes, but there was no one to enforce that.
And how crowded would this area have been? Nobody? No English-Irish settlers at all? Just very few?
Very few. There would have been, you know, sort of the eastern part of the state was settled much earlier. There would have been traders that had come through, French and English traders, but there was no settlement here until the 1750s.
So you alluded to the fact that in Pennsylvania at the time in 1749 that perhaps all the choice farmland, you needed more land because you had to have land to farm, and people who farmed really consumed at the time most of the crops they raised for their own food and sold what they didn't consume themselves. So I would assume that you would need a great deal more land than we today need to survive because you couldn't go to Harris Teeter and get your groceries. So they came here for land. They came here to get away from the churches. But were they a particular type of people? Were they particularly – did they like isolation? Because this was isolated.
I think – yeah, to some degree, I think if you came down here, you had to be willing to, mm-hmm. to live an isolated life. I think that – they came from a very mobile tradition. They were Scots-Irish. They had, within the last century and a half, they had moved three times from Scotland to Northern Ireland, Northern Ireland to Pennsylvania, Pennsylvania to North Carolina.
And each time for what reason?
Economic opportunity.
Hmm. Different world. It's hard to believe, but you say that these people were not necessarily the first white settlers to have arrived here. And you say that there have been non-Native Americans living in this area. Am I right about this? For centuries at this time, or did I misread that?
There had been as early as the 1560s, or maybe even a little bit earlier than that. Juan Pardo's expedition came through here. The Spanish looking for gold, mm-hmm. and then there were other traders who they didn't really settle, but they sort of lived among the Native Americans to trade for and other goods.
And what was the relationship of those people and later on the Scotch-Irish settlers who came here and established Charlotte? What was their relationship with the Native Americans who were already living here?
Well, by the time the Scots-Irish got here, the Native American population had dwindled considerably. So it was a pretty small Catawba group.
Dwindled because they left for better hunting grounds or to get away from the settlers or because they died off from disease brought by the settlers?
Disease. Do you know why?
Disease. Who actually owned the land from the British point of view? Of course, the Native Americans owned the land. But when the British came in, I guess they considered it theirs. They planted their flag and it became their land. So who owned this land that these Irish, Scotch-Irish people were settling on?
English lords had been either given this land, given large tracts of this land, or bought this land, you know, as favors, and they hadn't really paid much attention to it because there was no one there. So it's sort of a speculative land that they had. So by the 1760s, when it starts to get more and more populated, they start taking a closer look at it.
So in the 1740s, early 1750s, they just owned this land. It was there. It was 3,000, how many miles it is from England, I don't know. But it was thousands of miles away. They probably never set foot on it, never saw it. And there was really nobody here to, what, oversee it or supervise subdividing the land or renting out the land. There was just no oversight. So these settlers staked their claim.
Right.
And at what point, it was the 1760s, when they started to regulate this, when the lords who owned the land started to come in here and say, well, wait a minute now, this is our land, what was the reaction and what did they want?
They wanted rent. They wanted it's called quit rent. They wanted they wanted to reap the benefits of their investment. And the settlers we're dead set against that.
We're going to talk about that.
Sure.
Because that caused some problems down the way. Now, if people came here from nowhere, I mean from Pennsylvania, and they came into such something that was literally nothing. The Ritz wasn't here. There wasn't even a Holiday Inn. So if you're passing through or you're coming down here to explore and stake a claim, you either put up your own little temporary shelter till you find the place you want to build a house on, or you luck into perhaps staying with somebody in their already built home, or you luck in, or you're unlucky in finding that person, because you quote a traveling lawyer as writing about spending one night in a house in which his hosts blundered, bawled, spewed, and cursed, broke one another's heads and their own shins with stools, and bruised their hips and ribs with sticks, pulled hair, lugged, haloed, swore, fought. Thus I watched carefully all night to keep them from falling over and spewing upon me. That doesn't speak highly of the people who came here.
No.
Where did you find that quote?
It's in Waitsill Avery Journal. It was in a magazine article from 1855 from the North Carolina University magazine that had been quoted in different places. So I managed to track it down at UNCC Special Collections.
How did you go about finding some of this stuff? Because a lot of it is was unknown to me, and a lot of it is fairly descriptive and particular. It's not an overview. It kind of gets down to the nitty gritty in some places.
Right, and that's what I wanted to do. I really wanted to get in the mindset of the people that were living during that time. There's really a lot of good resources here at the Carolina Room. Downtown and various historical associations. So I just started talking to people and started looking at some of the documents that were existing and just kind of kept going down the rabbit hole to find more.
Chuck McShane is one third through a 12-part series on the history of Charlotte. He calls it The Story of Charlotte, and it's appearing in Charlotte Magazine, and we'll continue our conversation about some of the things he discovered as he did his research and began to write these articles in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Penland School of Craft, presenting a gala weekend craft auction in the North Carolina mountains on August 8th and 9th. Details at penland.org. Well, despite reports of a dramatically shrinking economy in the first quarter of this year, unemployment is down nationally and the stock market is soaring to record highs. There are many theories about why that is happening, and everybody's watching what's going to be happening with the earnings reports as they come out later this week. But in previous conversations about North Carolina's economy in 2014, economist John Connaughton, the keeper of the North Carolina Economic Forecast, said that this would be a good year for our state. Is that turning out to be the case? We will check in with him about that and about what the future may hold tomorrow at 9.
Thank you. On the next Diane Rehm Show, more than 50,000 unaccompanied children have been caught at the U.S.-Mexico border since October. The Obama administration weighs strategies to address the humanitarian and legal crisis.
Join the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Chuck McShane is our guest, writer, editor, policy analyst, actually, and also in the middle of a 12-part series, or the third of the way through a 12-part series, easy for me to say, on Charlotte history for Charlotte Magazine. You can see some of the articles he's already written by linking through on our website at WFAE.org. And by the way, you can also check out WFAE's monthly series, Along the Great Wagon Road, Occasional Detours to History, which explores the people, events, and communities that developed along the path set by the Great Wagon Road, which we've already talked a little bit about. It features Levine Museum staff historian Tom Hanchett, and you can listen to it at WFAE.org. Now we have an email here from Sandy, who is correcting me to say that it is Scots Irish, not Scotch Irish. I have heard both, so yesterday I Googled it, and it told me that both are correct. Mm-hmm. Where do you come down on this controversy?
I don't know the origins of it. I think that the more modern sources, more recent sources, say Scots-Irish, so that's what I'm going with.
Okay. So, Sandy, we'll say it your way for the remainder of the show here. Bill from Matthew's emails, there's an old saying that the pioneers get the arrows and the settlers get the land. Who were Charlotte's principal pioneers and who were the main early settlers who benefited from them? Do we know who the first people just to come through here were, or we certainly know the names of prominent settlers?
As far as we know, I'm sure people came here around before, but the first settlers to officially set up shop were the Spratts and the Polks. Thomas Polk was kind of the first settler, and he wound up being pretty prominent.
And of course, the Spratts are still relatively prominent because John Spratt, up until several years ago, was a congressman from South Carolina, right across the border in South Carolina, actually. So his family, emigrated to South Carolina, or did they change the border?
I'm not positive about that. There was some controversy over where exactly the border was.
So. And then there were what? So there were the Polks and the Alexanders.
Alexanders, the McNitts, the Brevards, all the uptown street names, basically. Yeah. Caldwells.
Davy, Caldwell. And there was an allusion, and I've forgotten exactly what context this was in, to the last name Bissell, which is a famous name today in Charlotte. And I forgot whether that Bissell was connected to the gold rush or some other event in Charlotte.
It was the gold rush. He came later on. He came down from New York in 1825 to kind of he knew more about technology. J. Humphrey Bissell knew more about the gold mining technology than any of the locals, and he came down and set up a gold mine.
So are the Bissells here today descendant from him?
I'm not positive. Okay. I would imagine so.
You quote an Anglican minister traveling from Charleston to Mecklenburg County as saying the area is without laws or government or churches, schools, or ministers, no police established, all property quite insecure. The people are vile, unaccountable wretches living off what in England is given to the hogs and dogs. How... Now, Charleston was a thriving port city at the time. How much of that description would you say is the account of someone who might be predisposed to see those who viewed him and his faith, which was Anglican, no doubt, as contemptible? And how much is accurate?
I think Charles Wood Mason, who's the Anglican priest, is kind of the colonial version of Simon Cowell. I don't know if that's a little bit of an outdated reference, but, he didn't like anybody, and he thought he was superior to everybody, and it's pretty hilarious, his journals. But I think it was probably a common sentiment from Anglicans about Scots-Irish. Maybe he was a little more intense than others.
One of the street names here, Selwyn Avenue, is named after Lord Selwyn, who owned much of the land.
Right.
And he sent surveyors to survey the land that he owned. But the settlers, who had been squatting on it for years, didn't even like the surveyors being there and gave them a heck of a time.
Henry McCullough, mainly, is the one they gave they gave a hard time. He was Selland's agent. He was actually sent there by his father. He was another one of these sort of port city kind of wealthy young person, and he came out and he just started to. He wasn't used to being told no, I don't think, and he came out and started surveying, and they broke his chains and ran him off.
And did that continuously, because the other people came out to replace him, and they did it again and again. But finally, Thomas Polk and some of his partners paid £90 for 360 acres of land that was owned by Lord Selwyn. Where did settlers, who you describe at some point as wearing bearskins and buckskins, where did they get £90 to pay for anything, much less land?
Well, Polk and the others had started working for McCullough after they had him beat. They started working for him, or after they had his agents beat. So they a select few, a handful, had been able to amass some wealth.
Hmm. And as you say, the Polks, I think it was the Polks, kind of traded sides several times in this argument up to the Revolutionary War, which we'll talk about later. In 1767, a courthouse rises at Trade and Tryon, what is now Trade and Tryon, and that really establishes a place on the map that could be identified as what has become Charlotte. Also, shortly thereafter, there was a tavern at the crossroads, and down College Street, a new college was established. Given the backwoods nature of this area, why would they have thought to establish a college?
Well, it was a backwoods area, but there were a handful of lawyers and ministers who had been Princeton educated. So they wanted a little more for their kids, I guess, and their sons, and they wanted a place where they could teach Presbyterianism. Or the Presbyterian ethic,
mm-hmm.
To the next generation of leaders.
And so they put a college down, and they've tried to find money to establish this college. How do they get the money to do it?
Through a liquor tax, which there was a lot of that going on.
Hence the tavern.
I
don't want to talk about the Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence. We've done a whole several series of shows on that and whether or not that legend has any basis in fact. But prior to the Revolutionary War, there was considerable unrest in this part of the state, and a group of farmers banded together. They were called the Regulators. Where did they primarily operate, and what were they exactly trying to regulate or unregulate?
Self-regulation, I guess, was where that term comes from. And they were mainly located in Orange County, Rowan County, some in Mecklenburg, not as many. A lot of them were Quakers, were Baptists, were very small, held very small amounts of property, or were propertyless, and they were really rebelling against the land transaction fees, the surveying fees, and just sort of a poor people's movement almost.
And so, who were they rebelling against? Were there actual people that would come to them and say, "We want X," and they didn't want to give it to them, or was it just the idea of being regulated in any way that they were opposed to?
It was a bit of both. I mean, there were to get your land surveyed at that time, you had to pay a series of fees at the mm-hmm. courthouse. Mm-hmm. So lawyers were really benefiting from that. by just getting a lot of fees from these poor folks. And there was an element of rejection of this outside authority of the governor, of a royal governor, and the Anglican Church too.
So how do they fight that? What did they do to – how do they operate, I guess, is the question.
The Regulators?
Yes.
Well, Herman Husband was sort of the leader, and there were – they sometimes stormed courthouses. I mean, when it came down to it, they would storm courthouses. They would occasionally accost lawyers.
So did the British go after them, or did other settlers who didn't agree with the Regulators go after them?
The royal governor went after them first, and the royal governor saw an opportunity to kind of get the Presbyterians on his side. This is Governor Tryon. So the Presbyterians, who had a little more money here in Mecklenburg, had a little more land, had a little more to protect, were kind of – and they were a lot of them were lawyers too, and they were – they were a bit disturbed by the regulation as well. So the governor saw an opportunity to bring them to his side by giving sort of positions of power. And so the Mecklenburg sends several militia units to help the British Governor Tryon put down the regulation.
Now, that was the beginning, I guess, of trouble in River City, so to speak. But the Revolutionary War actually began up north in the Massachusetts area and worked its way gradually down south. I guess there was Francis Marion, the Swamp Fox in South Carolina, who fought skirmishes. But a good deal of the war was from Virginia to the north. How big a role or how involved in the Revolutionary War was Charlotte?
It was fairly involved. It was a sort of a regrouping place. The early part of the war was mainly in the north, but then there was the Charleston, the southern campaign of Cornwallis in 1780, 1781, and Charlotte played a pretty prominent role in that.
Thomas Polk, who alternately disagreed with the British and who later fell into an economic league with them, became ultimately a brigadier general for the Patriots. Actually, that happened after he left the Continental Army because he was passed over for promotion by General Washington. He came back to Charlotte and said, "The heck with it." But as the war approached, evidently, he put money up, and therefore he became a brigadier general in the Continental Army. Allegedly, he later attended the Constitutional Convention, but you write that he has no writings about that in his personal records. How can that be? If you attend something that important, even in colonial times, why wouldn't you put it in your own journals?
So he was selected to go. He was elected to go. We don't know if he...
We don't know if he went?
We don't know if he went. He didn't write much. He sent a few letters here and there. A lot of what we know about him is secondhand.
Is his name on the Constitution? Did he sign it?
I don't know. I don't think so.
In the first great step of fortune, I guess, for Charlotte, this happened several years later, many years later, actually, a 12-year-old boy, and some people have heard this story, Conrad Reed, discovers gold along Little Meadow Creek east of Charlotte in 1799. Nobody knows what this is that he's discovered. How can that be?
His
father used it as a doorstop, rather, for years because he didn't know what it was.
There was just no experience with it, no knowledge of it at that time. They were farmers there.
So his father doesn't know what it is. He takes it to a silversmith. He doesn't know what it is. And finally, a jeweler tells Reed that it is, in fact, gold. And Reed asks for $3.50 for it. I don't know what $3.50 would have bought back in 1799.
About a week's wages.
But the jeweler later sells the bars he makes from the rock for $3,600. That is a tidy profit. So what happens next?
Well, people start panning for gold on their creeks and on their farms, on their property, and sort of a gold rush ensues. Reed, I think, eventually does sue the jeweler to get a little money back, but he realizes that he has much more gold on that property, and he starts mining it.
And the gold mining later becomes a major deal in Charlotte. Sure. It is to Charlotte then what banking is to Charlotte today. There were gold mines all over this town, where downtown is and where South End is. Where were some of these? And there were deep shaft gold mines. Where were these places?
Sort of by Panther Stadium, back sort of west of South End, a lot of them were there. Several of them, their shafts underneath the streets, where we are now. They're all over the place, and they're always finding new ones. So
when they dig deeply, like when they put the Duke Power Tower up, which was going to be the Wachovia Tower, and they had to go down for the parking garage, is it possible that they could have discovered more gold, or was the gold completely depleted by the time the gold rush ended?
It's possible that they could have found more. There was an article in the 60s when they were doing some, I think, First Union Tower or one of the older towers here that they came on a bit of gold when they were doing that. They just decided it wasn't really worth the effort.
I mean, there was enough gold here, and this was the first place we found gold. This is before the 49er rush in California, that one of three new United States mints was located here. Part of that was due to politics, but part of that was due to the fact that transporting gold over land to a mint to have it turned into coins was dangerous because you'd be robbed on the way. So if they did it here, there would be money to mint, and it could stay here and be used as money. Was there really enough gold to justify that here, or was that a political move mostly?
Well, you got to understand, it's not just Charlotte. It's all the Piedmont around had had gold mines. So, you know, I don't know. There were arguments about that. I don't really know enough about monetary policy.
So 1799 was when the gold was first found. How long did the gold rush last?
So the initial gold rush kind of was sort of slow developing in the 18-teens and 1820s. 1825, it really hits its stride, and that's when deep vein gold mining starts. Peak in about 1833, and then the panic 1837 kind of shuts things down for the most part. But it continues on after that.
And there were several rich people who came here and took advantage of that. You mentioned the Bissell, the gentleman of Fratton's first name.
Humphrey.
Humphrey Bissell, who came here because he had mining expertise. It also brought in an influx of people from Wales in England where they did coal mining because they knew how to go down deep and mine for stuff. And we had an influx of population. Then one of the other great things that people probably don't know much about is the fact that Mecklenburg County soil is good for growing cotton, and that was where the real money was. Now, most southern states growing cotton had slaves to pick it. Did we?
Absolutely. I think by 1850, there were about, 40% of the population in Mecklenburg County was slave.
How much?
About 40% of the population.
40%. And did this cotton growing ability eventually lead to what became the textile industry, or is that completely disconnected from this?
Well, I think that was part of the goal of the New South industrialist was to bring the mills to the cotton, to stop having to send it up north to the New England mills or off to England. So,
as I read through some of these articles, it became apparent that there's some kind of a theme running through some things. You report that by 1820, the state is at a standstill with politicians from down east who have large plantations rejecting investments in education, rejecting investments in infrastructure. Northern travelers refer to North Carolina as the Rip Van Winkle state because we slept through the revolution and didn't progress. Does any of that sound familiar to you? I'm just asking. And that was at the legislature.
Right.
When they talk about the state standing still, the legislature did not want to invest in education.
And it was an Eastern-dominated legislature. And, I mean, the cotton planters there, as long as they could, and tobacco farmers there, as long as they could get their goods out to the canals, out to the rivers, they didn't really. There was no sense of investing in anything else.
We're going to talk about the Panic of 1837 and how it affected Charlotte and the next big step in our development, which was also we defeated the legislature at its own game when it came to the railroad. And we will talk about that when we come back with Chuck McShane, who is writing a 12-part series of articles on Charlotte history for Charlotte Magazine, some of which you can read through a link on our website at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Dixon Hughes Goodman, LLP, a CPA and advisory firm headquartered in Charlotte. Over 1,700 professionals in 30 offices serving clients in the U.S. and around the world. Details at DHGLLP.com. More than 50,000 unaccompanied children have been caught at the U.S.-Mexico border since October. The Obama administration weighs strategies to address the humanitarian and legal crisis. Coming up at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, that's in 20 minutes. And by the way, you can catch up on the Story of Charlotte series in Charlotte Magazine via a link on our website, wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. And we'll talk more about the Charlotte story, the history of Charlotte, with Chuck McShane when we come back. Stay with us.
Crowded jails and tight budgets have states relaxing sentences for drug charges. Some prosecutors, sheriffs, and lawmakers don't like that.
I would like everybody that's on heroin right now to go get treated. But most of the time, when that come to Jesus moment happens, it's because of law enforcement.
The case against sentencing reform today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered, from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Chuck McShane, who's writing a 12-part series on the story of Charlotte, which begins at its very beginnings up to the present day. He's four installments into the 12-part series, and you can read them on WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. There's a link to the Charlotte Magazine website at that point. We've talked about the beginnings. We've talked about the 1799 discovery of gold. We've talked about the Revolutionary War and some of the things that had to do with that. But the economic panic of 1837 was a national panic, economically speaking, and we began to lose North Carolina, and Charlotte began to lose population to Alabama and Mississippi as banks closed and individuals went bankrupt. And you write that a lot of the businesses that had sprung up in downtown Charlotte to service the gold mining industry weren't getting paid, and they were taking out ads in the papers to beg their customers to pay their debts. One ad just say what? Pay up?
Pay up. That was a headline.
That was it. Did it work?
Don't know. I think probably some, but maybe not. I mean, you know, Charlotte lost, Mecklenburg County lost a third of its population, so a lot of people were just gone on the road. Yeah.
You also point out that petty politics was a welcome distraction at the time from the panic of 1837, and that it was a Fox News MSNBC battle at the time between the Whig controlled newspaper, the Charlotte Journal, and the Democrat run Mecklenburg Jeffersonian. They not only trade jabs at each other, they have eventually an impact on national politics. Talk about that.
Right. Well, they're able to oust the director of the Charlotte Mint.
They had the Whig newspaper had it out for him, or the Democrat?
The Whig newspaper had it out for him.
Because Democratic president, Andrew Jackson.
Andrew Jackson's last appointee.
Okay.
So, and their big thing was that he spent federal money on trees to landscape the grounds on West Trade Street.
Nothing ever changes.
No.
So they went after him, and they were successful in getting him kicked out of his job.
Basically, yeah.
But they also had an impact on a presidential election, didn't they, because of James K. Polk, these papers.
They had an impact here on Charlotte's remembrance of the Mech Deck, because Ezekiel Polk there was a big controversy. They were going to put up a monument of the Mech Deck downtown, and there's a big controversy over whether Ezekiel Polk should be put on the monument. Well, Ezekiel Polk is the grandfather of James K. Polk, who at the time is the Democratic presidential candidate. So the Whigs shut that down, and they never built a monument.
Which is why probably we still don't understand whether there was a Mech Deck or not. But both of these papers, the Whig-controlled paper and the Democratic-controlled paper, agreed on one thing, that Charlotte needed a railroad to survive. And we get one in 1852, which you call a turning point in our history. Right. How so?
It's the major turning point. It's what sets us apart from any other Piedmont courthouse town. It's why we're different than Monroe or Lincolnton or, you know, any of these other places. It connects us to Charleston, to the ports there, and it by having that, it brings other railroads in later on. And so by 1861, we've got four railroad connections coming out of here, and we become a hub.
Now, railroads, we have to remember, were a brand new technology, and not unlike the internet today. If you don't have an internet connection, you're pretty much out of luck. And right now, that's how it is. But back then, the railroad was a lifeline, because to get cotton from Mecklenburg County to Charleston, where it could be sold, took what, 6 days?
6 to 8 days.
And you had to use wagons, and you had to use barges, and the train cut it down to 24 hours. So what was the difference? Why, you know, everything moved slower back then, so why did it matter? You could get your cotton to Charleston in 24 hours versus 6 days. Did it cut down on the expense a lot?
Oh, yeah. The expense was, I mean, you could lose half your profit taking it down.
So given that, why was the state of North Carolina so slow in extending railroads? There was a plan to build a railroad from Wilmington to the mountains, and we were going to wait for that, but we didn't. Why not?
It just there was a reaction against internal investments. It just kind of got caught up in the legislature, and took too long.
So investing in the state, in the infrastructure, that's an example of investment in infrastructure that they were not interested in doing.
No.
So the people in Charlotte, business people in Charlotte, took matters into their own hands. And how they did this was pretty ingenious, actually, because there was a railroad coming from Charleston. It was going to go to Columbia, and it was going to go to Camden. Is that right? And we had to convince them to extend it to Charlotte. How did we do that?
So Charleston wasn't interested in getting a connection to Charlotte because there was nothing here. Charlotte didn't have the money to build one on its own. So basically, they knew that they could get, as long as they got to Charleston, they would be fine. Mm-hmm. So either Camden or Columbia would work. So they set up a committee and they started holding barbecues in these towns along the line and these farming villages along the line and on along both lines, and they had them compete with each other. So eventually, you know, like I think Fairfield County or Chester County gave actually more than Charlotte to the line because they wanted something to come through.
And so the Columbia line won. So they would go to Chester County and say, you don't want X County to get ahead of you now, do you? And they go to X County and say, you don't want Chester to get ahead of you, do you? And they were, parlaying one against the other till they got enough money to bring the railroad here?
Basically, yeah. It was a big contest.
But one of them lost. If Chester won, the other county lost. So how did they use the other county's money?
Oh, they refunded that. I mean, it was it was a contest and whoever,
Okay, so they got the money. And in 1852, it came here. You write that 20,000 people, that's a lot of people back then, gathered to greet the first trains in a celebration the newspapers of that time described as the most brilliant and glorious day that the history of Charlotte has furnished for 70-odd years. It really did change everything. It was the beginning of Charlotte business people taking matters into their own hands and achieving something that the legislature would not let them do. The great state of Mecklenburg wins over the legislature to that. And it also created a mercantile economy.
Yeah, it became the market for the area all around. People from Lincolnton and the other counties around would bring their cotton here and their produce and would get it shipped elsewhere. So they were sort of middlemen who kind of wholesalers and brokers who set up shop here.
And various small towns along the line between Columbia and Charlotte, like Rock Hill, became viable because of the railroad passing through. It also resulted in the establishment, you write, of the first Catholic church, St. Peter's, which is still downtown, and a small Jewish congregation. So it sounds like that it sets the stage for modern-day Charlotte, the arrival of the railroad.
Right, yeah. I mean, it brings all types of people through.
The Civil War comes after that. What role did Charlotte play in that, aside from being home to the Confederate Naval Yard, which is very odd to me, given the fact that we're so far from the ocean? But did we play a big role? Did the Civil War come through here at all?
No, it didn't. I think Stoneman's Raiders got to Catawba River on the western part of Mecklenburg, but no one else came close. We did play a role in that. Charlotte became sort of a hub for refugees from other places in the South, fleeing, fighting in other places in South Carolina.
And we were a hotbed of secession. The legislature voted not to secede initially. Charlotte was ready to go. And in fact, in 1859, they started the Mecklenburg Dragoons and the Charlotte Light Infantry to ensure that every suspicious person is watched closely. What were they looking for?
Well, I guess that's another part of the railroad. There's all these new people coming in, and they were looking for abolitionists, really, because there had been actually in the same paper that they announced that railroad celebration. There's another announcement where they discuss this runaway slave sort of conspiracy, where these slaves have forged papers calling them free blacks and have tried to escape, and so this scares the slave owners here. And they really clamp down on anyone who comes through, anyone with a northern accent, anyone who expresses any sort of radical abolitionist, they call it, sentiments.
Yeah, we threatened to tar and feather individual or so. Do we actually follow through on that in any case?
I don't know. They kind of make it euphemistically in the paper.
You mentioned that we're 40% of the population was slaves at one point in time. Going toward the Civil War, did we have more slaves, fewer slaves? Because that's a revelation. I didn't know we had enough slaves to have skin in the game, so to speak.
Oh, sure.
And if we wanted to secede, and the legislature was controlled by people from down east that had these big farms and plantations that did, in fact, use lots of slaves, why were they reluctant to secede, I wonder?
Well, the election there was a popular election for secession, and that's where people were against it. There was a newspaper editor, Williams Woods Holden, in Raleigh, who was very, very pro-union. We were just reluctant to give up our connection to the union.
Were there particular individuals in Charlotte who were leading the charge towards secession?
Actually, the railroad men. Colonel William Johnston was a big...
Johnston. Of Johnston Road.
Possibly, yeah, okay. I'm not sure.
All right.
But yeah, they were really behind it. And I think that it was the connection to South Carolina's economy, which was so much more reliant on cotton because of the railroad now, that made Charlotte more pro-secession.
So, and of course, South Carolina was the first state
right.
to secede. Textiles and banking would later transform the city into the city that we have become today. But in the 1920s, there was a serious hiccup that made national headlines and was the subject of books and movies, the Luray Mill Strike. It was the result of changing demand for fabric and staff and salary cutting. And the end to breaks in the day for things like baseball games among the factory workers, the textile mill workers. But it resulted in violence. Why?
Well, there was a unionization attempt by the National Textile Workers Union, which happened to be connected to the Communist Party. So that really heightened tensions, heightened emotions there. When the sheriff was killed, that's when things really got heated up.
Yeah, the sheriff was killed in the course of one of these uprisings, and that caused a lot of things to happen. And it spawned statewide suspicion of labor unions, which exists to this day, and led to several novels based on the events of that day. But as you write, it took 27 years to approve a 21-word statement on an historical marker, which reads, "A strike in 1929 at the Luray Mill, 200 yards south, left two dead and spurred opposition to labor unions statewide." That seems like an innocuous sentence, but it took 27 years to approve that for the marker. Why?
Well, I think one of the Gastonia county commissioners or city councilors of that in the 80s wanted to say locals shut down a communist uprising. It took people who with memories of it kind of dying off for it to really come back into the public eye, because people didn't want to talk about it. I think some station tried to do a documentary on it in the 70s or 80s, and just no one would talk to them there because it was a chapter they wanted to move on
right.
from.
Well, let's move on to 1978. Okay. We're getting to recent history now. And 1978 is significant because liquor by the drink was approved. I wasn't here then, but I do know that I was in South Carolina then, and I do know that liquor by the drink was wanted by the restaurants in this area, because they thought, and they were right, that it would not only bring people to their dining rooms, but it would cause restaurants to get better, and there would be more of them. We had this brown bagging law. What was that all about?
So it was I guess a compromise. You could bring your own liquor to the restaurant, and they would bring you know, if you had gin, they would bring you your tonic and your lime to the table, and you had to pour it under the table. And you know, it was a accommodation of a prohibitionist.
And the fear about authorizing liquor by the drink was what? Why, the people who did not want it to happen were afraid of what happening?
I think it was a religiously based opposition. They were afraid of bars on every corner is one of the things that keeps coming up in their rhetoric. And it was just the religiously there's a strong Baptist coalition here in North Carolina, and mm-hmm. Baptists don't believe in drinking.
Well, the First Baptist Church here downtown mm-hmm. Kind of spearheaded the fight against approving liquor by the drink. Henderson Belk of the department store family led the charge because he was a member of First Baptist Church, and that church predicted doom for the city of Charlotte upon the passage of this. We know that didn't happen, so how did the supporters of that change win, and what has been the result?
Well, Mecklenburg wanted it for the longest time. I mean, it took them three times voting for it to finally get the legislature to approve. I think that the result has been, if you talk to people in the restaurant industry, they say that it really opened the door for new restaurants to come in, chain restaurants to come in, hotels, higher-end hotels. It wasn't the only thing, obviously, but it was a nice icing on the cake for the development of Charlotte in the 80s.
You've written four of the 12 articles in the series, so you really haven't written up to 1978 yet, and nor have you written about 1968, which was a very important year in terms of integration for Charlotte. But as you write these articles and as you do the research, have you noticed anything emerging, a theme, a through line that connects us back to 1749 and those early settlers and their attitudes toward government or their attitudes toward religion or their attitudes toward life in general?
I think Charlotte is, throughout the history of Charlotte, it's never been comfortable accepting the lower expectations of other people. You know, it's always worked to kind of prove people wrong. I think that's why the trifling place quote is so resonant with people, because you know, we just love proving that wrong.
We'll prove you wrong.
Right.
Chuck McShane is a writer, editor, analyst, and the writer of a 12-part series on the story of Charlotte, Charlotte's history for Charlotte Magazine, some of which you can read through a link on our website at wfae.org/charlottetalks. And in September, The History of Lake Norman, Fish Camps to Ferraris, a book that he's written, comes out. Thank you for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins.